You look great.
Thanks.
Yeah, slightly unshaved and sexy.
How's your summer?
It's been fantastic. We had a ball at the Borderland. It was amazing. Community is really working, and I think it pulled off the best burn in Europe this year. And but in general, I mean, Peter and I swore a military oath to each other at the Borderland the last night. Well, if two straight guys are going to get married, unless you want to make a big sensation out of Sweden becoming the first country where they've gone full circle and straight men are now marrying each other, if you go back to the history of marriage, you will discover that marriage didn't start with man and woman. Marriage started with men marrying each other for a military service, as a military oath. And that oath eventually, when it was tied to property, became the way you married clans together, which is what marriage essentially is. It's you go outside the tribe and marry the clan with another clan. So that's that's about like 5,000 years ago or something like that. The military oaths are older than that, way older than that. So we just decided to go back to the original marriage, which is the military oath, and swear the military oath to each other.
Cool.
Based on Thebes in Greece, before the Spartans, the guys in Greece who really reinvented the military oath were the Thebans.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
So you have a girlfriend and a husband, or...
Husband is the wrong word.
Husband's not the right word. I didn't think so, yeah.
No, I've got a life brother who I live with, and I've got a life sister who I do not live with, but who lives with other women.
Okay.
Those are my primary relationships. We're already going, aren't we?
Yeah, well, I just pressed record right away this time because I didn't know. I thought something interesting would just pop up that we might miss.
I've been studying the Kushan Empire quite a lot recently. I find it incredibly interesting. And I think the reason why we have underrated the Kushan Empire in Europe is because this was, of course, the golden age of the Roman Empire. So, you know, about 100 years before Christ until what, 300 or 400 years later, the Kushans had invaded from Central Asia and occupied northern India. And it was the only empire that actually encapsulated both of India and most of Persia. An incredibly golden age where Buddhism and Zoroastrianism met, both state religions within the Kushan Empire. And obviously what we talked about before, you and I, about the Silk Trade Triad was really established. This sort of fruitful relationship between Taoism and Buddhism and Zoroastrianism as the in-between. The Persian, the Chinese, and the Indian religions. And of course, Tibetan Buddhism that you adhere to is a result of these marriages. So, people traveled. I mean, they were nomadic in a sense. People came from Mongolia peacefully all the way down to India and integrated with Indians during this time. And then spread, of course, Buddhism the other way. Eventually, Hinduism took back India. But Buddhism, on the other hand, was spread along the Silk Road over the rest of Asia. And it intermarried with Zoroastrianism. And I think an important thing we need to start studying, there's some scholars, some Asian scholars working in America today who started studying if this could also possibly be the root of Sufism. Now, of course, this is a really, really touchy subject because Muslims cannot make up their mind whether they want to include Sufism or not. Yeah. It seems Muslims want to include Sufism in Islam when it pays off.
Well, I know Sufis that say that Sufism is pre-Muslim. It began
It is. Muslim. Absolutely. Yes, it is. Absolutely. And there seems to be two different schools that could both turn out to be right. There's a Kurdish school that seems to locate the origin of Sufism in Mesopotamia, which was, of course, Persian before the Arabs invaded. The Persian Empire, the capital was Ctesiphon, which is basically now a suburb of Baghdad. So the origin of Baghdad is Persian. So the Persians built Baghdad, or Ctesiphon it was called, which is the capital of the Persian Empire. And Ctesiphon was then fighting Byzantium, which ironically had been the capital of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire moved its capital to the east, away from Rome to Constantinople or Byzantium. And the Persian capital moved from central Persia and Persepolis on to Ctesiphon, which is contemporary Baghdad, and then became the capital of the Persian Empire. And the Persian Empire, the Roman Empire, basically, you know, were the two major empires. And this was the struggle between Christianity and Zoroastrianism, while there were still, at least Christianity was still being formed and was still under a lot of influence. Mm-hmm. And this war exhausted both Persia and Rome. It exhausted both Ctesiphon and Byzantium. And it did so most of all because of a huge plague that hit Europe in the 6th century. There were two major plagues. The first one was in the 6th century, and the second one, the one we usually hear about, is the one in the 14th century. Mm-hmm. And they both devastated the Middle East and they devastated Europe. But the plague in the 6th century evaporated, you know, somewhere between a third or half of the Middle East population was wiped out. The Persian Empire basically went bankrupt because of the plague. So while Ctesiphon and Byzantium were still fighting each other, this opened up the entire Middle East for just about anybody.
What years are we talking about here now? Where are
7th century.
Are we still in the 7th century? Okay.
This is 7th. So the 6th century is when the plague hit. The 7th century is when you have the devastating results of a major plague in the Middle East and Europe. The Middle East was even more weakened than Europe was. Mm-hmm. So Byzantium was weakened. Ctesiphon, or the Persian Empire, was even more weakened. This is the end of the Sassanid Empire. So the Sassanid Empire, suddenly there was a little invasion coming from the south, from places called Mecca and Medina. We all know this is the Muslim Arab invasion. Mm-hmm. The Muslim Arab invasion was probably the fastest military expansion in all of history. We should remember Muhammad, not only as a founder of a religion, but more than anything, as one of the big military geniuses of history. Mm-hmm. And he basically conquered about half the known world. You know, they went all the way up to way into Siberia, conquered half of Russia, conquered Western China, and they were in India, certainly with the Mughals later, and they conquered all of the Middle East. And they took North Africa from the Christians, but they took the entire Persian Empire from the Persians.
Wow.
The Persian Empire even escaped to China. You know, escaped to Xi'an, which was the biggest city in the world at the time. Xi'an was the starting point of the Silk Route on the Chinese side, and Cairo was, of course, the other end station of the Silk Route on the other side. And Cairo in Egypt and Xi'an were the two biggest cities in the world, mm-hmm. closely followed by Baghdad and Damascus. Mm-hmm. And of course, the other major cities like Merv and Samarkand and the other big trading posts along the Silk Route. 6 out of the 7 biggest cities in the world were probably along the Silk Route when we come to the end of the 13th century. Mm-hmm. So, but before that, if you go back to the 7th century, this leads to the Muslim Arab invasion. And of course, the Muslims invaded way more than they had expected. Basically, Muhammad had set out to create something like a pop version of Christianity for Arabs, like a very simplified religion. Like, let's make it easy. Let's build a mosque that looks like a mamela, a breast. Let's build a minaret that looks like a phallus, a dick. Let's make it very Freudian and simple. And let's build mosques and minarets next to each other and have only one God and call this God Allah. And basically, this is God and Satan and everything thrown into one, and you've got the character of Allah. Now, it's kind of genius to make such a simple religion. The problem is, of course, that this religion was militarily successful, but could never be kept together. Didn't have a theological center of any kind. And still today, Islam is cursed by its decentralized
culture. And it was divided against itself, right? The Sunnis and Shia. Since the beginning, they've been fighting each other.
And you think about men function, like when men are really stupid, like large groups of men. If they can't have a theory that they agree on and a symbol of the theory, which is a high priest, they will instead go for a lineage. That's exactly where all the old religious books are full of. Well, he gave birth to him. There's a long lineages, you know, to impress on women or impress on each other, whatever. And that's essentially Islam. Still today, the conflict between Shia and Sunni is not a theological one, as you would expect between Catholicism and Protestantism and Orthodox and Christianity. No, the conflict is still one of lineage. Like, is it the guy who married into the family, or is it the grandson who should be in charge of things? Like, mm-hmm. and still today, that's Shia and Sunni.
Well, it's interesting. Like you and I are both interested in Tantra, and I remember going to the Ghibli Museum in Paris and seeing like before and after the Islamic invasions, and there was all this tantric iconography all over the world. Like, it wasn't just in India or Tibet, it was all the way, you know, all over the world, and it kind of disappeared after the 8th or 9th, I don't know the dates, but
point being that Zoroastrianism should never be mistaken for being some kind of proto-Abrahamic religion. The relationship between Zoroastrianism and the Abrahamic religions is virtually zilch. But the credibility of Zoroastrianism, since it was a state religion of the Persian Empire, was that the Muslims wanted to claim Zoroastrianism was a religion of the books. It was like they considered it like a very complex form of religion prior to Islam. And mostly Islam and Zoroastrianism actually had a very peaceful relationship. They still do today. But this is dead wrong, because the historical connection Zoroastrianism must make is with Buddhism, and it is with Taoism, and it is with the Eastern traditions, definitely an Eastern religion. And the way you see it is that the Mobids in the Persian Empire, say the Sassanid Empire, that's like from about the birth of Christ up until the 7th century in the Arab invasion. This is the Sassanid Empire. It was just as important as the Roman Empire. It was centered on Persepolis, and eventually they moved the capital to Ctesiphon, which is like currently Baghdad. And this was the center of the Persian Empire. And Zoroastrianism was the state religion. And they considered anybody who was agnostic or anybody who was a dualist of any kind, the Manichaeans, they considered them to be heretics. And they would execute and go after them mercilessly, because Zoroastrianism is fundamentally a monist religion, exactly like Buddhism and Taoism. So if it's a monist religion, it has nothing to do with Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, that are all dualist religions. This is fundamental to the shift and the difference between West and East. When we discuss West and East, historically,
we're talking about dualism and monism. That's your separation between West
that
and
East? That is the separation. We don't have a single trace of monism before Thomas Aquinas starts playing around with it in Europe. And then eventually that leads to Spinoza, who is the first openly monist philosopher in the West. And Spinoza was cursed by the Jews. He was cursed by the Christians. They considered him to be this horrible infidel. I mean, he came along with these ideas that he'd gotten from who? Sufi mystics in Spain and Portugal. You were killed in Europe if you were a monist. Mm-hmm. You were persecuted and killed. You were persecuted and killed in the Islamic world if you were a monist, unless you were a Sufi. So this is the origin of Sufism. So we have Sufism definitely to thank for Spinozism. So the arrival of monist thinking that comes, of course, under the umbrella of philosophy, not theology, although Spinoza claimed to be a theologian and not a philosopher, we gladly placed him in a new camp that we called philosophy. And in the world of philosophy from the 16th century forward in the West, you could think all kinds of weird and wicked and strange ideas without getting executed, because you were, of course, a philosopher. This is a whole new academic discipline. So you took it out of theology, because if you stayed within theology and claimed things that the Catholic Church, or at least Luther, did not agree with, you had your head chopped off. Mm-hmm. Okay, but if you left theology and had no claims to the fortune of the church, you could be a philosopher and you could think more freely. But even with Spinoza, it was his friend Descartes and Leibniz who realized his genius, and they were all, you know, contemporaries. They defended his right to speak his mind. So philosophers started speaking them, you know, for each other, like, no, wait a second, I'm Descartes, I have these ideas, I'm a dualist, I don't want to break with Christianity because I'm actually dualist. And actually he took dualism to a whole new level. I mean, if anybody took dualism seriously, it was Descartes. So the modern dualism we have in the West, we inherited from Descartes, and that's why I talk about Cartesian individualism, and I talk about Cartesian dualism all the time. But Spinoza introduced monism, and in a weird way, so did Leibniz, except that he didn't really understand. Probably that's what he did. Leibniz and Spinoza were much closer to each other, and you have to read them next to each other now when you study them. But I find it interesting that the kickstart in the West for a monist tradition, starting with Spinoza, then being fulfilled by Hegel, etc., starts with Sufis. You could not have Spinoza unless his family had Portuguese Jewish origins. And the Iberian Jews often accepted Sufi mystics and found them interesting. And in the Jewish tradition, you could, of course, be a mystic. And as a mystic, you could explore monism. And yeah, you could, you know, think of Jehovah as maybe being the universe or something. You could definitely do with the law, at least if you were a Sufi. So we have to go back now and trace the origins of Sufism. And I find it incredibly interesting that we explore one. I talked about the Kurdish explanation, which is, no, this started out in the bazaars of Basra and Baghdad. Mm-hmm. So when Islam took over and Baghdad now became the new capital of the Arab world, Basically, they just took over Ctesiphon from the Persians and said, you know, a few miles west of Ctesiphon, we build a new capital along the Tigris, and we call it Baghdad. You already had Damascus, you already had Cairo. So then you have three major, huge urban centers in the Islamic world. And that led into the Islamic Golden Age, where essentially the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Mesopotamians and the Persians created the culture that the Arabs claimed were there, was theirs. And this is the Muslim Golden Age. So, but I find it interesting. So this is a claim that the Kurdish tradition could be the origin of Sufism. The other claim is that it started in Central Asia. You heard of Yazidism, right? The local Kurdish religion that's non-Muslim, etc. Yazidism really is a folk version of Zoroastrianism, and they are collaborating now. Zoroastrianism has been declared an official religion in Iraqi Kurdistan. And of course, a lot of Kurds are not that happy about being Muslims any longer after having been raped and pillaged by the Islamic State. So there's a lot of conversions going on now in Iraqi Kurdistan. And they convert to Zoroastrianism, and they can also keep the Yazidi practices, because that's just considered the folk version of Zoroastrianism. So It is Oda Mazda, it is Zoroastrianism all around. And this, again, why Tantric Buddhism is the connection between the two, is that we don't see a single example of conflict between Zoroastrians and Buddhists until this day. To me, they're yin and yang. They're just like so closely connected, but they're just two different, radically different sides of the same coin. So to me, Zoroastrianism is the phallic version of an ur-religion, where the magical version of that religion is Buddhism. And it's more like you and me. It's a matter of taste, whether you want to call yourself a Buddhist or a Zoroastrian. Mm-hmm. They actually complement each other perfectly. Taoism, you've tried to unify the two into one religion. Mm-hmm. But there's something brilliant about actually keeping two religions separate within the same empire. It can actually be more fruitful. And I think that's exactly what they did in the Kushan Empire. The Kushans came from Central Asia.
Can I ask you a question before you go on with the story?
Yep.
Why do you think Zoroastrianism is phallic and Buddhism is matriarchal?
Zoroastrianism is all about linear history. It's all about we started here and we're going to build an amazing, glorious future up there on the hill. So we're going to take humanity and build a civilization, and we're going to shock ourselves and the world by creating an amazing future together. Completely phallic. And it's not about having been in a paradise that we fell out of, that we're going to try to restore, which is the Judeo-Christian tradition. Now, if you're going to separate spirit and body, you better have a place where they were united in the beginning, then separated, then the body became dirty and sinful and sex, you must hate it, and all the shit that goes with Judeo-Christian religion and with Islam. And then one day, maybe the Savior will come and save us and bring back the paradise. That is the trajectory of Judeo-Christian Islamic religion, of Abrahamic religion. With Zoroastrianism, there is no such starting point. There was no paradise. There was the original tribe. It was nomadic. And the nomadic life then became settled. And the difficulty of the shift from the nomadic to the settled is what Zoroaster is concerned with when he formulates his religion 3,700 years ago. And this is a religion of process and change. It's an ever-changing, ever refreshed religion that does not believe in perfection, but believes in wholeness. It believes in completion of their life, and it does not build pyramids, which the Egyptians did, which then inspired the Abrahamics to do the same. No, they just threw away the bodies in nature when somebody died, something that Tibetans later copied and took in from Zoroastrianism. You throw away the body, somebody's dead because they're dead, they're over, they live their whole for life, and it's time to go to the next generation and keep building the civilization. Nothing can be more phallic than that. The phallic is the longing to transcend who you are and the generation you belong to and create something better and higher than what we currently have. Mm-hmm. This urge is the phallic. And okay, that's exactly why the Zoroastrians invented the first Messiah. So the Messiah that Jews later copied for the nation of Israel was a universal Messiah, which is why Söderqvist and I are now digging into this concept. The name for that is the Zoroastrianism. So the Zoroastrianism is a concept that was invented 3,700 years ago by Zoroaster, located somewhere in contemporary Uzbekistan, which was Khorasan, a Persian kingdom at the time. And in Khorasan, Zoroaster declared his new religion, and the new religion was phallic, and it declared, we're going to build a better, higher world by adding more complexity and being able to handle that complexity. He more or less kickstarted the revolution that then started with written language. The higher complexity level would enable us to create a more complex and therefore better society. That's what we call civilization today. Okay. Civilizationism starts with Zoroaster. And the interesting thing is, he was not a Platonist. He did not believe that there was a perfect world we should imitate to try to create. No, he believed that the world was ever changing. And he called this concept aurvatat. We strive towards wholeness in our own lives to one day die, pass on the world to somebody who can then improve on it. Mm-hmm. That is phallic. And this is why the Celtiant is part of the mythology. So, you know, the thousand-year Reich, we should take back that term from Hitler because it was invented by Zoroaster. But the end of an epoch, at the end of a thousand-year empire, when things fell apart and decadence set in, mm-hmm. the Celtiant would come and save us. And of course, for a long time...
That's very Judaic as well, isn't it? I mean, there's
they copied it totally from the Persians. Mm-hmm. It was in Babylon that they copied the concept of the Messiah. So the Messiah is the idea that the Jewish people, the nation of Israel, have their own savior that will come and save them. And of course, King David was the first one who was the Messiah. You know, they made up Moses before King David as an historical figure. He never existed. But Moses was, of course, another Messiah. So these are leaders. But for the Persians, this is what's important. Whereas Israel, to me, is the name of the perfect nation, the name of the perfect empire is Persia. And what the Persians then inspire us to do today is to recreate that into the universal empire that we somehow have to create to save the planet today. So we have to go back to these traditions. We have to dig into this. And what I find encouraging here is that we can even give the Muslims a role if they go with Sufism, because it's within Sufism that you and I can find something that aligns with your Buddhism and my Zoroastrianism.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I've known that for a while.
We need to study more carefully. Sufism can be so many weird things.
It can be terrible things, yeah. But that's
exactly why origin is so important. I always go to etymology when I use words. I always tell people that if there's several different interpretations of a term, then, you know, don't believe the last American best-selling writer as the best interpreter. No, go to the origin of the word, etymology, and study the word, and then claim it again. So the same thing here. We should really try to find the origin of Sufism, which definitely is pre-Islamic. There's an enormous Buddhist influence in Sufism. Mm-hmm. There's definitely an enormous Zoroastrian influence. I would say it's a confluence. Mm-hmm. I would say the Kushan Empire plays an absolutely key role here. All the scholars I've talked to claim the same thing. The Kushan Empire, with Central Asians who walked all the way down to northern India and established an empire for 400 years, that also included Sogdia, Bactria, the entire Silk Route was controlled by the Kushans, meaning there was a flow, a constant flow, trade and information and knowledge from China through Central Asia, down to Persia and into India. So this was a golden age for culture. Why we know so little of it is because we, number one, neglected it, and number two, the Mongol invasion destroyed most of the manuscripts from that period. So we need to go carefully forward and try to use whatever means we can have to study this historical period. Because I think for you as a Tibetan Buddhist, for Buddhism in general...
I'm not a Tibetan Buddhist. I don't...
Yes,
not,
you are.
I'm not Tibetan. No, I'm not. I don't attach Tibetan to it. I'm a Vajrayanist.
Okay.
Nothing to do with Tibetan. My teacher is American, and the practices I do are English. I'm not Tibetan.
Good defense. I accept that.
Yeah, okay. At all.
Can we go for Dzogchen then?
I'm not obsessed with Tibetan culture. I don't wear Tibetan clothes. I'm not into Tibetan fetish. You know, this kind of ugly.
And I'm not very Persian. I've had quite a few Persian dinners in my life, but
yeah, there you go.
I believe Zoroastrianism is. Still is the only properly universal religion, possibly combined with Buddhism. And I think that connection, the Zoroastrian-Buddhist connection, is the best narrative we have today going forward. By the way, we're going to talk about Fravaka, aren't we? Going to talk about him today. Another Buddhist thing.
Well, I was laughing a bit earlier because I was struck by the contrast between your grand narratives, your dramatic grand narratives and this sort of subtle psychologizing that happens on the American continent or something like that.
Yeah, you know what I think of psychology. The problem with psychology
What's the problem with psychology?
It's an American innovation, and whenever I talk to an American who wants to defend psychology and considers it to be so damn important and central to our thinking, they always quote other Americans, which just proves my point, that psychology is really a science, social science, built on Cartesian individualism, and that is its problem. No, you don't have to start with a single human being and then add another human being, and then you have three and four people, and finally you have a tribe. No. The tribe is where you start. I would claim a one-liner here that maybe I could be attributed to. That one-liner is, when you talk about human beings, nothing is less than 157.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. Our starting point for being human is the tribe, not the individual. The individual was invented by Descartes in 1632 because there were people who sat and read books around Europe, and they discovered the power that they felt when they read books and had their own relationship to God and the world and all that. It enabled us to create Protestantism, would never have happened without the printing press, but it also enabled us to create a secular religion called individualism. And America was built on individualism. So the entire American construct is one that we are not really unified at all, except that we wave a flag and we're all individuals. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a sort of weird union between 300 million individuals. That's the idea of the United States of America. Now, Americans don't seem to understand how weird this is to the rest of the world and how exceptional it is. And actually, there's nothing to do with the history of ideas anywhere else in the world. It started in Europe, that's true. But except for maybe England, the rest of Europe didn't care too much about individualism and started problematizing it pretty early. And we reached the French Revolution. We got Rousseau and his bullshit going on. Certainly not individualist any longer. But then we certainly got Marx, who speaks about the classes and class war. And, you know, we got Hegel, who talks about the system and the absolute and the nation state. And all these great thinkers in Europe, they really don't care too much about individualism. And the striking example is when Freud, the old Freud, came to America, and he got very popular in America. He was another one of these eccentric European intellectuals that Americans like to import now and then. And he was imported to America, but he just found it disgusting because the Freudians in America hadn't really understood Freud at all. They turned his psychoanalytical teachings into nothing but American ego psychology.
Or self-help.
Psychology. Ego psychology is the most American thing that I could possibly think of. So this obsession with me being me alone, and this obsession with consciousness, like subjective experience and things like that, to me, those things are actually quite marginal to human beings in general, to the history of ideas, to anybody who recognizes that I'm a human being, I'm a flock animal, I'm a social creature. 99% of the ideas that go through my head are actually ideas I've gotten from other people. I might have a tiny little effect on those ideas before I pass them on to somebody else. That's called memetics. But really, you know, I'm just bin where things are thrown in and things are thrown out. And I try to make sense of the world. And when I relook at myself, I discover that my subconsciousness dictates way more of my behavior than my consciousness ever does. We are literally not very conscious of anything that happens to us.
Well, I agree with that.
Yeah, and the idea of making consciousness this central thing, like it's so central, is one of the major narratives of what it means to be human, is today, I think, a very American idea that Europeans have given up on, also realizing the rest of the world didn't really care.
It's funny how also they instrumentalize things like Buddhism for that, right?
You know,
Buddhism is about becoming conscious, or, you know, that kind of, you know.
Like, yeah, it's like Western Buddhism has very little to do with Buddhism because it has everything to do with American ego psychology. And it seems to be like Americans cannot import anything unless they're allowed to take the filter of ego psychology and put up and then filter ego psychology through. That's exactly why when we talk about people we love, like Camille Paglia, Jordan Peterson, John Favreau, the North Americans that you and I love the most, right? They always have a problem with this guy, Jacques Lacan. And I'm beginning to understand it because Jacques Lacan perfected psychoanalysis. He took the heritage from Freud and Jung and perfected it. It's really hard once you get into Lacan's psychoanalysis to get out of the trap that he puts you in. And for him, subjectivity is nothing but emptiness. It's just an empty hole that tricks you into doing all kinds of things, or tricks you into believing all kinds of things. But in reality, your body and your subconsciousness have already decided for you just about everything you do. And modern neuroscience proves that this even is the case, which is now really screwing it up for the psychologists who all along believed that self-awareness and consciousness was so important. And they've been sitting there meditating, waiting to have some kind of empty consciousness, which to me is just ridiculous. Why? Why is that important? I don't care. Well, to get rid of your big American fat ego, maybe that's a good idea. For the rest of humanity, we're probably already, as soon as we start, you know, contemplating about the surrounding world, it's more like, okay, how am I going to get along with other people today? I'm going to have some relationships around me so I don't have to feel lonely. Do I have a team of people that I can build amazing things together with? And how can I contribute to society? Those are the things that human beings in general find more important. And none of them has anything to do with this sort of American Broadway mentality of, if you make it here, you make it everywhere, you know, which is ego psychology's most extreme form. So This is the problem we've got with
self-obsession, maybe, right? Is that a good way of putting it?
Self-obsession, narcissism, hello. Yeah. And it hasn't helped that we got the internet, and the internet was basically a very American phenomenon, has been, at least until now. Influencers and everything we got today. The first 25, 30 years of the internet has been an obsession with yourself, until people are now gradually discovering that there's nothing more boring than a narcissist who writes newsletters about himself. And it's very American. Mm-hmm. It's very American, right? We're tired of it. We're sick of it. We're discovering it doesn't work. Well, maybe individualism in itself never worked. Maybe it was a bad idea to begin with. And it all led into these silly ideas that we're all competing with one another, and that life is some kind of competition between individuals. The most absurd form of it all is, of course, Ayn Rand's idea of objectivism and, you know, egoism. I mean, there are two massive ways of misunderstanding Friedrich Nietzsche. One of them is called Adolf Hitler, and the other one is called Ayn Rand. And I seriously haven't made up a mind yet on who of the two misunderstood.
Which of the two are worse?
Yeah. Because they're both equally bad, philosophically speaking, right? Equally bad. Uh-huh. So, no, there's no objectivism ever in Nietzsche. Nietzsche understood how lonely we are. He understood the Kantian revolution. He understood how the categories are cursing us, and that we have to think through the categories to understand the outside world. And Nietzsche still dreamed. He still dreamed of, you know, the individual. He's Cartesian in a sense. He dreamed of the individual who could set himself free from the illusions of reality and claim to himself his own values. Mm-hmm. This is the Nietzschean hero. Mm-hmm. And in this sense, Nietzsche fulfills the Cartesian.
But is that individualism, you know?
Yes, it is. It is. This is Nietzsche's problem. Now, what Peterson and Paglia and Ferrecchi have all done, and they're all Nietzsche's, is that they go back to Nietzsche and they tie in with Nietzsche and call it the meaning crisis. Yeah. It was maybe a very elitist, literary, philosophical thing in the 19th century. It's now a mass phenomenon.
Yeah.
We've all become Nietzsche's, right? But the response to stay with Nietzsche is the incorrect one. What I wanted to do in my work is to see Nietzsche as my hero too, and then kill him. My patricide is going to be the killing of Nietzsche, because we have to move on from Nietzsche to some deeper concept and a deeper understanding of what it means to be human. And I've got a name for it. Mm-hmm. Launch the name here, right? You know,
Syntheism?
Will to live. Now, will to live was Schopenhauer's idea.
Oh, will to intelligence, you were going to say. Is that it?
Exactly. Will to live was Schopenhauer. Will to power was Nietzsche. And what Söderqvist and I are working on is a philosophy that we call will to intelligence.
Oh, I like that a lot, yeah.
Wille zu Intelligenz, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, philosophers have avoided
the because that is the answer to the meaning crisis, isn't it? I mean, increased intelligence.
Well, it does one thing. You don't have to be human any longer to talk about intelligence, or have to be humanistic and save the human race.
Mm-hmm. It's not a humanistic project.
No. And Nietzsche was adamant. He was an anti-humanist. He despised the humanist. He saw no reason at all to be humanist.
For the same reason you've been talking about with this American sort of self-obsession and
anthropocentrism.
Fear of self-consciousness, fear of having a greater vision, fear of that sort of thing.
Yeah. And you have a couple of thinkers we should name here. We have, of course, Gilles Deleuze, who besides Lacan is the greatest of the French thinkers of the 20th century, an amazing philosopher. I'm using Deleuze a lot. We started with Deleuze. We're using Deleuze in our next book. We're using Deleuze all the time. And I've got an old brother of mine. We talked about him before. That's Manuel de Landa. And I would really put in a word for Manuel de Landa. He's probably the best of all the North American contemporary philosophers. Manuel de Landa has been a professor of architecture at Princeton for years. He's a really interesting thinker. He doesn't get it all right all the time because he's lacking, actually, in the Department of American Philosophy. The two things I lack in de Landa's work is he hasn't studied Charles Saunders Peirce, the greatest American ever, and he hasn't studied Whitehead, the greatest British thinker ever, who, by the way, was, of course, a philosopher in America in the early 20th century. Peirce and Whitehead are America's two greatest contributions to the philosophical pantheon. Manuel de Landa has the potential to be the third, but since he's avoided Peirce and Whitehead and gone straight for the European monistic thinkers instead, like Spinoza and Deleuze, he's lacking in that department, because there's a lot to learn from Peirce and Whitehead as well, especially about being consequential with process. Whitehead opened up the door for quantum physics. Without Whitehead, we'd never have Niels Bohr, we'd never have quantum physics. So to understand fully what process really is, to understand the primary aspect of time over space, what that means, I don't see any of this in de Landa's work, at least so far. But de Landa has done a great job at bringing Deleuze to America. Mm-hmm. And every time you walk by a skyscraper that has a rooftop garden on top of the skyscraper, you see what we call Deleuzian architecture. The idea of blending green straight into the urban world and put trees everywhere in the city and all that, that's all Deleuzian thinking. De Landa would claim so too. So De Landa is a guy to read and check out. Manuel De Landa, remember him? We're old friends. And, you know, we were sitting on skyscrapers in New York in the 1980s dreaming about being philosophers one day, and we both became philosophers. De Landa's old friend. Definitely worth checking out. And there's something interesting here, because de Landa obviously is not aware of what Pagla, Peterson, and Ververka are doing in mass education, young people today who understand we live in the middle of a meaning crisis. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they're dealing with that, and we embrace that. But de Landa is actually on the other side already, in that he actually sits on the answers without knowing it. We have to figure out a way of uniting these two different streams in American thinking. So Manuel de Landa on his side needs to be more imperial and be more. He's written a brilliant book called A Thousand Years of Nonlinear History, which is fantastic. Imagine you rewrite the last 1,000 years of history from the perspective of virus and bacteria and ignore human beings. Mm-hmm. Then the plague was a great golden age.
Right. Yeah.
Why not? So de Landa is trained in thinking anti-humanist. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then you might, like Deleuze did, you become a vitalist and you focus on life. That's the first step. So life in itself becomes important. There's quite a few ecologists and ecotopians, as we call ourselves now, out there who think life is maybe more important than human life. So life in general can be more important than human life. They risk running into problems like, I want to keep the white rhino and kill the human being to save the white rhino. Okay, they have those little hypothetical problems they might have to solve, but you could then go for life. I would say, why stay at life? Because when we look into what life really is, a life form as a separate cell cannot exist without two things. It needs a membrane, a way to communicate with the outside world where it can differentiate between can differentiate between things that are beneficial to it and things that are dangerous to it. So it has to learn to communicate with the outside world and let in that which is beneficial and throw out that which is dangerous and keep danger out, right? Mm-hmm. That kind of membrane is the model for anything human beings then build. You know, if you build a town, you put, you know, a wall around it to protect it from the outside world. That's a membrane, hopefully, not just a stupid wall, but a membrane. You let things in, you let things out to survive. Okay, that's how a cell operates. But that requires that the membrane can remember all previous transactions. So it can remember that, okay, that was beneficial to me yesterday, I'll do more of that. That I thought was beneficial yesterday turned out to be dangerous. I will not repeat that mistake. That I thought was dangerous yesterday, but I should have known it was beneficial, so I'd give it another try. That was literally dangerous. Good, now I remember it's dangerous. So I know it's dangerous, right? So you're on and off switches. That requires memory.
So could I just I have an intuition that you're talking about artificial intelligence in some sense.
No, I'm still talking about biological intelligence.
I know, but wouldn't that be the proper use for artificial intelligence?
No.
Okay.
Well, I'll explain why. This is how membranes operate.
Okay.
This is how membranes need memory. And as soon as you have a membrane and a memory, you have life.
Yeah.
That means biological intelligence and life are the same thing.
Okay.
There is no life that is so stupid, so it's not intelligent. That means biological intelligence is also emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
They are the same thing. That mm-hmm. means if you talk about will to intelligence, you can remove Schopenhauer's will to live.
Mm-hmm.
And it's redundant. You've already embraced life. Then the next question is Nietzsche dreams about will to power. Like, mm-hmm. I want to expand and, you know, grow. Well, that only what happens with a life form when it runs into competition with other life forms. So say you got a certain set of resources in a certain area, and suddenly you got a lot of thriving life forms in that area. And suddenly some of those life forms are dying because there's not enough nutrition for everybody. That then looks like it's a will to power, because the only life forms that would exist are the ones that somehow have figured out that they use their intelligence to expand.
Mm-hmm. Darwinian.
Exactly. Then you get Darwin. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you get Darwin. But the thing is this, when Nietzsche wants to make will to power some kind of ethical principle, he's wrong. No, that's just a byproduct of Darwinian evolution. There's nothing more to it. So intelligence, though.
Can you go back and say that again?
Will to power is nothing but a byproduct of Darwinian evolution.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Remember that Söderqvist and I are siding with Darwin against Nietzsche. Darwin, we are more Darwinian than Darwin himself. Whereas Nietzsche has a limit to how far you can go with Nietzsche. He completes the Cartesian revolution, but he ends up as the last and biggest proponent of Western individualism. And that is his response to Christianity, and he will also fail. Just like Christianity failed and had its death born into it from the very beginning, individualism had its own death born into it from the very beginning, and that's when individualism is dying in Nietzsche's.
That's interesting. That's like Nietzsche is the death of Christianity in a way. You know, he called himself the Antichrist, but he's
the death
of the last Christian in a way, or the last.
Well, he's the last Cartesian, to be honest with that.
Mm-hmm.
So we're finished then with Cartesianism and Nietzsche. And what we look at then is will to intelligence. And then we can look at, okay, so we created machine intelligence. Great. Now, is machine intelligence similar to biological intelligence? No, not at all. That's wonderful. Because then we can work towards something Daniel Schmachtenberger, we should credit him for that, has already called symbiotic intelligence. There's no conflict between man and machine. Intelligence in itself is not evil, because intelligence in itself strives to check if it can unify itself with other intelligences.
Mm-hmm.
Two cells would try to find out, what if we unify and become a larger cell?
That's why we so easily merge with technology, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the great thing of machine intelligence, what we take to it, is precisely because it does not mimic human intelligence.
Hmm.
Human intelligence should be understood as biological intelligence, and starting from plants and moving on to animals, we get higher and higher complexities. They can handle more and more information. And of course, animals too are life forms that can store and memorize things, and they have memory, and the memory teaches them to do certain things again and again, and to not do certain things and again, and to try new things. Okay, so that is how we learn all the time. And animals learn, dogs learn, horses learn, they learn throughout their lives. And so
that's human intelligence. That's human intelligence. Can you help me understand machine intelligence? Like, because, you know, clothing, right, is technology and fire and starting from the beginning, and then now there's
we have not been able to create life, okay? So even we're going to do synthetic biology, and it's going to be huge this century. We're still going to use life forms that already exist and then tame them and domesticate them. So synthetic biology is going to be the next level of domestication. The human domestication of nature. You know, I love genetically modified foods. That's why I'm ecotopian, not environmentalist. I love nuclear power, by the way, too. I love technologies that actually enhance human life. And if technologies can give us better, cheaper food, and if technologies in more sustainable ways without putting pesticides out there, and if technology can give us more abundant, cheap energy, all for the better. Okay, that's why I'm an ecotopian, not environmentalist. Yeah. But when we go to machine intelligence, the advantage of machine intelligence is that it's actually incredibly stupid, but it's incredibly fast and reliable. It's the speed and the reliability of computers that makes
it. Okay, I've got another quantum jump in my mind when you said that. I think it's like, yeah. This is like slavery, right? In a sense.
Yeah, yeah. And finally, we have happy slaves.
Happy slaves. Machines are happy slaves.
They don't we give finally a have arrived, and we can stop being hypocrites about slavery. Human beings love slavery because we are lazy bastards, and we love somebody to jerk off our dicks and kind, you know, do all kinds of things. We love slaves, right? So we had slaves before, and then we fooled ourselves into believing we become good human beings, and we didn't want slavery any longer. It was just basically that we got rid of slavery because why pay for somebody 24 hours a day when you can pay for their upkeep only 8 hours a day, and then you call it work.
And then, so then you have wage slavery or whatever.
Yeah. Now we don't even have that because, you know, a lot of work is redundant or whatever. We're going to invent a lot of new really cheap service jobs for people so that will keep them busy and, you know, give them some kind of money they can spend. Universal basic income is never going to happen. What's going to happen is that the service sector is going to expand and expand. Like they've done in America, we're going to see the same thing in the rest of the world. You're all going to have jobs in the future, but they're probably going to be cheap jobs and poorly paid. Okay? But you're going to have jobs, right? But slaves, good slaves that work hard 24 hours a day, never bitch and complain, are called computers.
Yeah.
So the machines will be our slaves. And here comes the most important thing. What will be the number one thing we need to tell the machines? What is the biggest dream we have today to save ourselves and to save this planet for human life?
Well, we have to distinguish between the machine intelligence and human intelligence, right? Or biological intelligence.
We've talked about it. I said it started in Persia 3,700 years ago, and the Jews copied it for themselves, mm-hmm. which is the biggest story of them all. Okay, we need a damn savior.
Uh-huh.
Okay. What is the best mission we could possibly give a machine that's...
So the machine's going to be the Messiah sort of thing. Is that
exactly
what you're leading to?
Okay. Got it. That means why messianic storytelling is so important, and that is where I'm moving with Sudeikis next and the completion of our trilogy, hopefully in the next 3 or 4
that's
years.
That's so kind of like the opposite of what everybody's thinking. That's so interesting.
Exactly.
It's the total opposite of this dystopian story that everybody is telling. It's very
well.
Very cool to hear that. Anyway.
Well, we could go down in flames.
We could go down in flames too, obviously.
But there, you know, when you say messianic, it's always a gamble, and it's always going to involve a few people. That's what's called an exodus. The few people who actually adhere to your message and actually take it seriously, and most people will not. But the people who will create some kind of an exodus into the digital vertical world we're moving into, and they're going to take this idea with them that by creating a community of people who are devoted to the cause of creating the messianic machine. Mm-hmm. Now, there you go. That is the biggest story of our time. We've been pointing towards it, Sudeikis, over the last few years. We wrote the Synthesis book to basically lay the framework for it and say religion, everything is religion. You know, individualism is just bad religion. Christianity is just dead religion, but it's still religion. Okay, how do you create a living religion that you actually believe in that will get people moving in the right direction finally and understand there's something more meaningful that's about to happen and could happen even in their own lifetime? Well, then came Digital Libido, which is the warning. Second book of the prophets, always the warning, says that if you don't adhere to the story we're about to tell you, you're going to go down in flames. So the next 50 years, conflict.
The current
culture wars are a perfect example of that. Now when the culture wars have even hit Burning Man and Wikipedia, we're in deep trouble. There's not a single space left in American or English society today that isn't infected with the culture war, and it's devastating. It's devastating.
It's just ugly. Everything. Just, it's a plague of ugliness or something, right?
It is, absolutely. And I've warned about it. I've said all along, if you ignore Charlottesville, you do it at your own peril. Portland, Oregon today literally is a war town between these two camps. Charlottesville has moved to Portland, Oregon, and now has a permanent address.
Yeah.
Where these guys are now building bombs, and that's where Antifa and that's where the alt-right are going to throw their bombs at each other for the first time, and they're going to love it. Because they love eschatology, they love to go down in flames. There's this inherent nature to human beings that they love warfare and they love apocalypse and they love eschatology and they love to kill them. Mm-hmm.
They're waiting for the rapture of some kind or to go down in flames,
or,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, or to die as heroes.
Just die as heroes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. We need to come up, but this is not a third alternative. I am not saying we created a synthesis or a way out of a dilemma like Charlottesville, because that would just bring us back into the old corrupt society we have to leave behind.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the institutions today. I despise politics. I despise academia. Yeah. I despise the corporate sector. I despise all the guys out there who are the old institutions, who are the old power structures, and do nothing else but try to defend their privileges. That's why we have this sort of deep popular uprising against Washington, D.C. Now they're going after Silicon Valley next. And Silicon Valley is just a bunch of nerds that are defenseless. That's exactly why I want to get out of the tech giants as quickly as possible. I don't want a life that's dependent on Google or Facebook or any of these companies any longer, because they're so damn vulnerable now. They have no principles. They don't stand for anything. And as soon as there's an attack somewhere out in the media, they try to follow that and try to please everybody. Now, people who try to please everybody and kiss your ass all the time, never trust them. That means you cannot trust the tech giants of Silicon Valley at all. That's why smart people like Peter Thiel and Eric Weinstein, all those guys are getting out. So you're getting out of there. We need to create something new. Dominic Tarr and Scuttlebutt and these guys are, those are my friends that I'm most impressed with at the moment. These guys who try to create new flat technological structures that cannot really be damaged by, say, the culture wars at all. So these are systems that are immune to the culture wars, and they're immune to the old institutions. That means political institutions, academic institutions, the central banks of the world, the corporate sector cannot infiltrate these things. These are the new sort of anarcho-libertarian heroes out there. The syndicalists and I have predicted will lead the way to the exodus. So it's within these communities you find the people that are going to be the winners, the real heroes. They don't make money today. They don't do tech startups. That's just the first wave of the autocracy. No, no. You're coming as the third wave, way later. And you come as the third wave to take benefit of what the internet truly is, write on it in an honest, radically honest way, understanding that you have to be radically honest to survive. Trust the algorithms as they point the way forward. And with the algorithms, you have the exodus towards the messianic machine.
Hmm. You have to be radically honest to survive. That's interesting.
Well, it's all built on intelligence. And if you look at biological intelligence and you look at machine intelligence, BI and MI, combine them, call it symbiotic intelligence. Symbiotic intelligence with man and machine both work together at their optimal. So you create any system that involves the best of human capacity and the best of machine capacity, and they collaborate together to create the largest possible output. That's symbiotic intelligence, that's SI. I never use the term artificial intelligence. You'd be thrown out right away. It's totally not interesting. It's a misnomer. So symbiotic intelligence is the way forward. The question is then, what is symbiotic intelligence? Where a pure, clean, I'm almost sounding moralistic here, a pure and clean ethical algorithm will be key. A nervous algorithm that is prone to change depending on how politics is changing or how media is changing, or an algorithm that can be infiltrated by social lynch mobs like Google searches today, terrible. But we can create deeply honest algorithms. We will need blockchains to do it. The race of my Burning Man and Wikipedia are also now falling to the culture wars because they're not blockchain. Anything that's blockchained cannot be changed. And then it cannot be altered by lynch mobs. It cannot be altered by the moods of the day or the fads of the day. And that's the only thing we can trust in the future is the algorithm that is immune to fads and fashions. That locks in history at any given point in time and says, this is what actually happened.
Because this is the next thing, because...
That algorithm will be so brutally honest that will open up humanity to brutal honesty between each other. And that is the only way forward. Any trader who worked along the trade route knew that if he wanted to do a deal with somebody from a different clan than his own, which is what he did all the time, mm-hmm. he had to go to a bathhouse in the afternoon and a whorehouse in the evening before he could trust the other guy. So they were naked together and he could trust him the next day and sign a deal. Everything since then has been about trust. Mm-hmm. And trust can only occur when there's transparency. Okay. The only way you trust another person is by seeing straight through.
People being naked together, metaphorically speaking.
That is what algorithms can do. This is what blockchain can do. Why do you think you have an obsession with blockchains and contracts? Because contracts is the fundament of what civilization, as Zoroastrianism describes it. It's precisely by writing a contract and signing a contract that this property is yours and this property mine, so you can invest in your property, I can invest in my property, and then we can trade with each other and we both benefit from the gains we thereby make. That is the basis of civilization. And to me, now, the culture wars are killing absolutely everything. That is just a reminder that the next time we create something like Wikipedia, we have to create it with a blockchain algorithm so that it's totally immune mm-hmm. to the hysterical lynch mobs out there, because anything that is affected by the hysterical lynch mobs out there, by the Rousseauianism of the day, is gonna go down in flames. Mm-hmm. Portland, Oregon being, you know, the evidence of that. We need to create something way more stable than that. And stability is phallus. And to do that, we've come up with another concept I'm glad to present, and we call it the root of the phallus. Okay.
The what?
The root of the phallus.
The root of the phallus. Okay, the root of the phallus.
Mm-hmm. The bottom of the phallus.
Like gotcha, that. Gotcha. The root. No, the root chakra, to use corny, terrible.
Exactly, okay. Root chakra. So that's a good term. So we take that from Buddhism then in order before it. And so root of the phallus, Okay. The Zoroastrians talk about phallus all the time. So does Freud, but they never actually discuss the phallus in detail. Okay. Well, the phallus has details. Okay. When you build the skyscraper, what is the most important thing you have to do? And that you spend 90% of your time in doing during the architecture.
The foundations, the preliminaries.
The basement.
Mm-hmm.
The basement. Okay. What do you do today to build a fantastic vision like the one we're working on here with the Messiah machine and everything? How do you build that? How do you come to these conclusions? How do you come up with these ideas? You go deeper down into history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The problem with Favreke, by the way, anybody out there who want to, you know, fill the gaps and the holes in your conception of history, John Favreke is the best damn YouTube teacher you're ever going to find and teach you thinking of the past 3,000 years. That's brilliant. But yeah. You can go before that, and then you come, of course, to the original tribe. And the original tribe started about 200,000 years ago with the first Homo sapiens in Africa. And then it moved on until about 5,000 years ago when civilization occurred. And during that period, 195,000 years, all our genes were created, meaning we are still mm-hmm. socio-ontological, meaning we are still the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're still the same people. That is something that Peterson and Paglia and Favreke never discuss. And the reason why they don't reach to the Messiah ideas is because they haven't gone deep enough into history. So if you go deeper down into history, to the root of the phallus, you go back 5 or 10,000 years, and then you go back 150,000 years, and you get the whole genetic makeup and understand why human beings work the way they do. You get the archetypes, you understand why people are different, you understand why everybody in the society has some kind of a role, you understand the difference between men and women, and you understand why they're androgynous people. You get the full tribal map. The only way to do that is go deeper down into history. We can call that deep history if you like. Mm-hmm. But deep history, when you're then moving to philosophy and you're going to create something into the future, becomes the root of the phallus. Because you want to aim high.
Okay. So the deeper you go, the deeper the you go, the higher you can aim, in other words.
Exactly. Yeah. You got it. So we got will to intelligence, which is more Buddhist in the sense that will to intelligence operates like you think of cells and membranes and life forms, and they lie next to each other and they sort of touch each other and they go intertwine with each other and then they sort of separate and then they go back in. And you know, you look in a microscope and see life, you know, it's just bursting. It's just like that never happens in computers. Computers just on, off, on, off, on, off. So the total opposite of computers. But that's how biological intelligence operates, right? That is kind of flat structure. Whereas we dream vertically, which is phallic structure. So you could say that life or intelligence in itself is kind of a Buddhist thing. But once you add will to it, and you talk about will to intelligence, which is like we want to get somewhere, you become a Zoroastrian. Because you then say no to the Buddhist ambition of killing your desires. Mm-hmm. And if I hadn't found what I believe gives my life meaning, which is the messianic story I'm talking about here, and I want to complete this as a philosopher, if I hadn't found that, if that had become totally impossible, if the meaning crisis really had arrived at a point where there could not be any meaning again and religion could not be recreated, I would gladly become a Buddhist. I think it's a very sound response to the
Buddhism doesn't have this prophetic quality that's
why Fervaike is a Buddhist. Mm-hmm. Okay, highly respect that choice. It makes much more sense than being some kind of ironic Christian, which is where Peterson arrives all the time.
Well, he's kind of an ironic Buddhist, actually. I have a slight problem with his Buddhism.
But Fervaike is Buddhism.
He's astounding. Stephen Batchelor, you know, Stephen Batchelor wrote this book called Buddhism Without Beliefs.
Yeah.
I think it's ridiculous to have, because you can't have, that is a belief to say Buddhism without belief. It's like, I believe there's a Buddhism with a, it's like this Buddhism that can be whatever, it's I think he wants to become sort of a post-Buddhist Buddhist, but he won't take on the whole.
Sounds very sutra, thing. Not very tantra, sounds very sutra.
Yeah, going up to Mahayana.
And if you do sutra Buddhism, you only do half of it. That's for certain, right? Like you both and I are into tantra, so.
Yeah.
And tantra is, of course.
I think
tantra is the surface, yeah, against which Zoroastrianism fits in with Buddhism. You cannot understand why Zoroastrianism complements Buddhism unless you first become a tantric Buddhist. Mm-hmm. Because tantric is the phallic aspect of Buddhism, where sutra dominates Buddhism, which is why I call it a magical religion. You could say that, well, I could, as a Buddhist, take on any of the Zoroastrian beliefs. Yes, you could if you become a tantric Buddhist. The problem is you're still fighting a religion that claims that the extinction of desire is the ultimate goal. No, it isn't. Mm-hmm. Death is not the goal. Death is just the end point of the narrative. Mm-hmm. The meaning is actually to protest against death, live as long as you can, live the wholest, fullest life you possibly could have, and then accept death, because if you hadn't accepted death, life would be horrible. That is the Zoroastrian take on life and death. Mm-hmm. So we are born, we know we're gonna die, we know life is meaningless unless we create meaning in it, we know we could just prolong our lives in a sort of meaningless existence where we're too scared to even kill ourselves, and that's the mortito.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's
you could live like that, and Freud says, unfortunately, most human beings have no more self-confidence than that, and they stay in the mortito most of their lives, and they never even show any kind of libido. Okay, mm-hmm. Libido is a vain protest against that. It's like, yeah, I've got a dick, and I want to make things, and I want to create things, and I want to build skyscrapers, and I want to be the Messiah, or have the Messiah come and create something wonderful and amazing. Okay, well, that desire might be ultimately vain, because you're going to die one day, but that's just a truism. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely obvious. No, because when you die, you pass on the world to the next generation. Mm-hmm. That's how the world survives.
Yeah,
that's how you prolong life. That is adding value to life that goes beyond your grave. And you create something for others to take up and do something with before you die. That's called heritage. And that's a deep, deep human desire. And I would say heritage could be also an aspect of will to intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Heritage.
But we have to look at the actual arguments for that before we actually claim something like that. Maybe some of the followers we have here, friends of ours that are following us, could add to that discussion. Could heritage be an aspect of world's intelligence? Well, you know, when does a life form become so intelligent it realizes it's going to die one day, and that fact it's going to die one day is actually an escape of some kind, and because that's an escape, add value can be added to what happens before that escape occurs.
Mm-hmm. Like teaching or something.
Well, I think language certainly made it possible for us as human beings to understand we're going to die one day. And that's, of course, both a curse and a blessing. But that's what we're always dealing with. Fravaki talks about it. Peterson talks about it. Tyler talks about it. Anybody's talking about the meaning crisis right now constantly talk about the fact that human beings know they're going to die one day. Mm-hmm. They cannot comprehend what it's like to die. Mm-hmm. They can comprehend that other people are dying, but you cannot comprehend that you're going to die, which is, according to Lacan, is the one little thing you say for yourself to not expose back to yourself that yourself is an illusion, right? Mm-hmm. The last thing you say of yourself, in your sense of self, to not have to deal with the fact that yourself is an illusion, is the fact you save it by not being able to comprehend that it can go away and die. Mm-hmm.